Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out all the events. As always, we got events coming up in 2021, which of course it is 2021, so this year. We got events in Northwest Arkansas and of course the national event out in San Diego. Go to herewestillstand.org or just the events page. You can check out all the information for those. That Northwest Arkansas event is coming up in April. So if you are looking to hang out with Chad and I for 2 days, along with a bunch of other people, you can sign up for that. We'd look forward to seeing you. It's going to be a good time. It's a cheap one to come to. I mean, it's $65. You come hang out with a bunch of people for 2 days and have a good time. Chad, we left the story in a sort of unpleasant spot. So we had a bunch of priests get massacred. We had some foreshadowing of what will happen to those who are found on the right side of David or his son. So we got a little martyrdom preview, and just had to leave it there. So hopefully we were able to move on to somewhat more positive things, even though the life of David for the next little while is going to be rough.
Yeah, I was looking ahead these next two or three chapters, and you're right. I mean, really through the rest of the book, it's this cat and mouse game between Saul and David. And we're going to see more of that, especially these next couple chapters. Even when you finally get to Saul's admission, at least he finally says it plainly that he knows that David is going to be king. Even after that, which is chapter 24, he still continues to pursue David. So yeah, it's going to require the death of Saul to finally bring this to an end. I mean, there's just nothing that's going to stop Saul from, reneging on his word or, reigniting his jealousy or whatever it might be to pursue David once more. The only thing that's going to stop that is finally the death of Saul. So we're going to be enjoying as much as we can this cat and mouse game for several more chapters. So you're right. We left off with verse 19 of chapter 22 of 1 Samuel with this massacre of the priest that was carried out, I'll remind you, not by an Israelite, but by basically a foreign mercenary, Doeg the Edomite, who was the chief of Saul's shepherds. He was the one who stabbed David in the back in the sense that he told Saul about David's visit to the tabernacle and how the priest helped David out. And of course, the priest had no idea that Saul was after David at that point. He just was doing David a favor. So Doeg not only informs Saul about what the priest did, but then when Saul's own soldiers will not carry out this massacre, then Doeg turns around and not only kills those priests, but he ends up basically destroying the entire city. Men, women, animals, everything was wiped out.
I was thinking about that, and you're like, man, what's the point here? What is Saul trying to accomplish when you're talking about, not just, okay, I'm going to kill this priest, but I'm going to kill all these other priests. I'm gonna kill men, women, children, ox, donkey, sheep, all of it. All right. So he destroys all of it. And I think what he's doing is that you've got David on the run. You have David starting to amass a little bit of a military entourage with him. And it seems that what Saul is trying to do is make an example of this place to say anybody who would harbor David, give aid to David, befriend David, this is the game you're playing if you do that. So if you destroy this entire village, certainly you would think word would get out about something like this. And if people ask why, they would say, well, for giving aid to David. Now, as horrible and evil and awful as that is, I suppose if that's what you're trying to do, this would probably be a good way to make people not want to help him.
Yeah, he was definitely using them as an example. And we'll see in the following stories that the message was heard loud and clear because people seem to be going out of their way to turn David in. Saul is hearing from these people, hey, David's hiding here. Hey, David's hiding here. Come get him. So they seem to be going out of the way to kind of ingratiate themselves to King Saul because, well, they don't want the same thing to happen to them that happened to the priest.
Yeah, I don't think it's out of love and admiration for their king. I think it's out of, if you lay eyes on this dude, you better report it because you don't want to have seen him and someone find out that you've seen him, even if you didn't do anything to help him. But if you even see this guy, you better report it, because Saul's crazy. I mean, if he finds out that you laid eyes on him and didn't tell somebody, you might end up with your whole family dead.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of the culture of fear that's created by a insane dictatorship, more or less, which is really what has happened with Saul. He was, first of all, the divinely appointed leader, but then when God withdrew from him, he exercises his reign solely by the use of raw and unfettered power. And of course, he uses power to create fear. And this fear then compels people to, you know, abandon basically morality, you know, and any kind of faithfulness that they might have to David, who is an innocent victim here. And instead, yeah, they're out for one thing. They just want to save themselves. So we learn from the end of chapter 22 that even though there was this whole-scale massacre in the city of the priest, the city of Nob, that one guy escaped. Verse 20 says that one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahituv, this guy's name was Abiathar, he escaped and fled after David. And then when he gets to David, he tells him that Saul killed the priest of the Lord. So he reports this whole sordid affair to David. And then David replies, he's kind of, you can see David's mind at work. He's thinking back to that particular day when he stopped at the tabernacle and there was Doeg, the Edomite, standing there. And David says to Abiathar, you know what? I knew on that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul. And then we have David, kind of the polar opposite of Saul here. David taking responsibility for something that he didn't really even do. He says, I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household. So we have a complete contrast here between Saul. Saul orders the murder of all of these priests, taking no responsibility for the crime. And then David, who was not responsible really at all, still taking responsibility by saying, you know what, this is on me, because every one of them was killed on my account. And then he issues this guarantee. He says to Abiathar, stay with me, don't be afraid, for he who seeks my life seeks your life. Then he adds, for you are safe with me, or with me you shall be in safe keeping. Kind of interesting, I was looking at the Hebrew there for safe keeping or safe with me. The word is mishmeret. It's a noun form from the verb shamar. Shamar is to guard, keep, watch. So a guard is a shomer, a watcher. But what's interesting about this word mishmeret is that in almost all of the cases where it's used, the people who are engaged in the guarding or the keeping safe or the safekeeping are priests. So they guard the temple. They make sure the temple is safe, or they're guards at the tabernacle. But here we have the opposite. Here we have a priest who is now going to be under the guardianship or the safekeeping of David. So it's a reversal of roles in this particular case. David's making sure that the priest is safe.
I love this word. This is exactly what Jesus means when he says, keep my commandments. He does not mean do all these things, but he means he's looking for someone to keep them around, right? To guard them, to stand watch over them, to know where these commandments are, not to forget them, that kind of thing, which is a much fuller thing that Jesus is saying than just simply like, and do the stuff I told you.
Yeah. It's a word that comes up in, I can't think of which psalm that is. Is it Psalm 130? Anyway, it's like, the Lord is my keeper, the Lord is my shade at my right hand. You know, the Lord will keep you from all evil. All those keep type words are shamar. So it's him keeping you safe, guarding, watching, those kinds of activities. And yeah, it's the same word that's kind of behind this idea of keeping commandments or guarding his word. So keeping it safe, keeping it close, watching over it. So a bit of background here before we jump into the next chapter. There's a sort of a strange fulfillment taking place here. If you remember back in chapter 2 of 1 Samuel, when you had a corrupt priesthood and you had a prophet that appeared to speak to the corrupt priest at that time, one of the things he said was that the household would be destroyed the household of those priests would be destroyed and eventually be replaced by another priesthood. This is sort of one act in that long ongoing fulfillment of those prophetic words. So in this case, it's almost all of Abiathar's family who are killed. Abiathar survives, and he is going to become the priest of David for a long time to come. In fact, through all of David's reign, Abiathar will be close to David as not only his priest, but his advisor, his friend, one who is who's watching out for David, even like during the coup of Absalom later on. But at the death of David, Abiathar makes a fatal mistake. He supports Adonijah, the one son of David, instead of Solomon, the other son of David. He supports the non-chosen son of David to replace David. And as a result of that, when Solomon, who wasn't Abiathar's choice, when Solomon becomes king, he banishes Abiathar to another city. So he must leave Jerusalem. And then he replaces him with Zadok. So another priestly family or clan takes over the leadership of the priesthood in Israel. And that finally is the fulfillment, the final fulfillment of that long process that began in 1 Samuel chapter 2. So this is one of these strange things where you have a prophecy and then you have a horrible thing, this mask of the priest that happens as a partial fulfillment of that. But it's going to take another few decades for it finally to come to its fulfillment. But this is part of that process. Okay, so chapter 23, what happens next? David finds out that the Philistines are attacking a place called Keilah, and they are plundering the threshing floors, it says. Now, Keilah, or Keilah, however you want to say that in English, was located on, it was in the territory of Judah, but it was right at the border between the territory of Judah and the territory controlled by the Philistines, which, of course, makes it susceptible to attack by the Philistines. It says they're, you know, they're fighting there, they're plundering the threshing floors. I'm kind of envisioning this, you know, it's harvest time, so they're bringing the grain to the threshing floors, and they're trying to get it all taken care of, get the grain gathered up, winnowing it, all that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, the Philistines come in, and the, you know, the kind of these guerrilla attacks, they'll come in, they attack, they take the grain away from these people. So, of course, puts them in a very difficult, dangerous position. So David wants to help them out, but he doesn't want to just like leave and go and attack. He wants to inquire of God first. So it says he asked of God, or inquired of God, which, by the way, that verb that's used for inquire is sha'al. It's the root of Saul's name, Sha'ul. The verb is sha'al. So another kind of maybe a little poke at Saul there. So Saul, he can't inquire of God. The person whose name means asked can't really ask God for anything because God's not going to respond. But then David over here is asking, is shawling God, and God responds to him. So he inquires and says, shall I go and attack the Philistines? And God says to David, yes, go and attack the Philistines and deliver Keilah. Now, we don't know for sure how he found this out. How was their asking, and how was their responding? We're really not told.
I'll throw this out there. I mean, we had talked about how, you know, God sort of just talking randomly to people is diminishing. It may not be a coincidence that David now has a priest around, and then he's like, I need to go ask something of God. And you know, we don't have it in the text, obviously, that he went and asked, you know, this priest to inquire of the Lord. But this also, like, inquire of the Lord, this is a priestly thing to do, right? Is it possible that we just heard about we got a runaway guy from a family of priests, and David's like, you know what? I need to ask God something. I'm going to go inquire. I would argue that it is not unlikely that that is how that goes down.
Yeah, I think it's one of two possibilities. It's either that, or we know that David had the prophet Gad with him, mm-hmm. who just kind of shows up in the story and attaches himself to David couple chapters ago. So it could be one of the others. I mean, we do know that, of course, people quite frequently inquire of prophets so that they could inquire of God for them. So it's either one or the other. I personally lean toward Gad only for this reason. We're going to get to it in a few more verses. It's a little bit ambiguous as to when the priest arrived, because at the end of chapter 22, it seems like he just showed up, right? But then you go down a little bit further to verse 6, and it kind of makes it sound like he shows up to David while he's already at Keilah. So we'll figure it out as we go along. But that's one of the two possibilities.
Yeah, and I think what's the least likely is the third possibility, that David just asked God, "Hey, God," and then God told him. I think that's probably not what he did.
No. That would not be a very Old Testament thing to happen. I mean, that does happen early in the book, like in the book of Genesis. You have these conversations between like God and Abraham, but it diminishes greatly over time. So God says, first of all, yes. And which, you know, presumably was enough for David's. Like, David's like, all right, here we go. But it says David's men, they weren't so sure about that. They say in verse 3, David, like, we're in Judah and we are afraid. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the ranks of the Philistines? And I think by that they mean, look, we're safe in the territory of Judah right now. Keilah is on the border. So if we go all the way over there against the Philistines, our likelihood of making our way through this safely is not going to increase. It's going to decrease greatly.
Yeah, I don't think it's just the Philistines that they're afraid of either.
No, they're definitely afraid of Saul at this point too. So David, he's going to make sure. He's going to inquire a second time. So he inquired of God once more, and basically the same answer came back. Arise, go down to Keilah, for I will give the Philistines into your hands. So God is, you know, patient, giving a double confirmation of his will for David and his men. And sure enough, of course, that's what happened. David and his men went down to that city. They fought with the Philistines. And it says he led away their livestock and struck them with a great slaughter. And so David delivered the inhabitants of Keilah. So everything, of course, went as God had planned.
This is the sort of news when it reaches Saul that I'm sure he would be overjoyed with. Oh, well, good. I'm glad the town is saved.
Yeah. Well, and you would also at the same time think that the inhabitants of this city would just be overjoyed.
Yeah.
With what David had done for them. And so, you know, be willing to do anything on David's behalf. But as we will soon see, no good deed goes unpunished. And David has to leave that city because of what God is about to tell him. Now, verse 6 is the one I referred to a couple minutes ago. It says that it came about that when Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, fled to David at Keilah, that he came down with an ephod in his hand. So this is the ambiguous arrival. So did he go to David? So he gets away from the massacre, right? He goes to David. Now, did he go to David at another place? And then when David goes to Keilah, he shows up there too? Or did these two events kind of happen at the same time? While Saul was attacking the city of the priest and Abiathar escaped, was at the same time that was happening, was David now delivering the inhabitants of Keilah? We're not sure. Either way, when Abiathar the priest comes to David at Keilah, he doesn't come empty-handed. Evidently, when he saw this massacre happening, he had the sense of mind to run into the tabernacle, because the tabernacle was located there at that time, and grab the ephod that would have had the breastplate and the Urim and Thummim in it. He grabs that and he runs away.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing, because when did this guy show up? Maybe David didn't use him to inquire of the Lord, but at the same time, you're like, but he does have the things that you need to inquire of the Lord. Like, exactly. He'd be a good guy to inquire of the Lord. He's got like all the tools, right?
Yeah. He's got the lots, right? If you're going to cast lots, these are the lots you want to cast. So verse 7, when it was told Saul, so Saul hears that David came to Keilah, Saul all of a sudden becomes optimistic. He's like, ah, now this is my opportunity. God has delivered him into my hand, which is a really strange thing for Saul to say. I mean, he didn't say, oh, this is my lucky day. He didn't say, now I've got him. He says, God has delivered him into my hand. So either he is naively optimistic or he's deluded himself. We're not sure, but he seems to think, and he's going to say something similar later in the chapter, May you be blessed of the Lord because you have told me where David is at, more or less. So I'm not sure what to make of Saul. Like, what's going on in his head? Is he just saying this? Does he really believe it? Is he naive enough to believe it? But he seems to, at least if we take his words at face value, he thinks that God is still on his side. God has delivered him into my hands.
Which further speaks to the madness of Saul at this point. The reason you can't figure out what's going on in his head is because this is a very mad place to live. I don't think there is any figuring out what's going on in Saul's head, because there's all kinds of strange things going on there. And I do think that this response is exactly what David's men were concerned about. Like, we're gonna go fight a battle? Like, that seems like a good way to give away your location.
Yeah, if there's any person in this world to truly be afraid of, I guess is the right word to put it, it's a madman who thinks that God is on his side.
Yeah, that has who has a bunch of power.
Has a lot of power. There are few people in this world more dangerous than those who are either mad or half mad, have a lot of power, and who think that they have divine approval. I mean, we have all world history to document situations such as this. So he says that this is his chance. God has delivered in my hand. Why? Because now David is no longer just, you know, hiding out in a cave. He's no longer just in the wilderness. He's locked himself in. He's shut himself into this city. So Saul gets all his people together to go down to Keilah to besiege David and his men. Now David knew, verse 9, David knew that Saul was plotting evil against him. So he decides he's going to take advantage of his priest. He says to Abiathar the priest, bring the ephod over here. And then David begins to inquire of God by means of the priest and the ephod. And he really has a couple of different questions to ask. David says, O Lord God of Israel, your servant has heard for certain that Saul is seeking to come to Keilah to destroy the city on my account. So here's the two things he wants to know. And when God answers these questions by means, presumably, of the Urim and Thummim, he answers them one at a time. Because as far as we can tell, the way this worked is that you had to sort of ask a yes or no kind of question to get a response by means of these sacred lots. So here are the two questions. Verse 11, will the men of Keilah surrender me into his hand? And then the second question, will Saul come down just as your servant has heard? Well, Lord God of Israel, I pray, tell your servant. So here's the Lord's first response. He will come down. All right, so we have two questions. God answers the second question first. Yes, Saul will in fact come down here to besiege the city. And David wants to know, perhaps more importantly, will the men of Keilah surrender me and my men into the hand of Saul? And the Lord responds affirmatively to this as well. He says, yes, they will surrender you. So this is the no good deed goes unpunished kind of scenario. No gratitude for the deliverance that David and his men have given to this city. I suppose they figure it's better that one man perish than that the whole city perish.
I'm sure they're like, look, man, like, we're really grateful that you saved the city. Also, if we don't turn you over, that was for nothing, because we saw what just happened.
We're all
going to
die.
I mean, it's not as though it's unreasonable for the inhabitants of this place to think, if we don't do this thing, it might have been better if the Philistines just went ahead and just kept doing their, let the Philistines plunder away, man. Because if we don't hand you over, that's nothing compared to what Saul's going to do.
Yeah. So, you know, for all that we rightly hear about, like, ancient customs of hospitality. You know, if you bring somebody into your home, you're supposed to treat them as your own family member and care for them. Well, I'm not saying that's not true, but do keep in mind too that ancient rules of hospitality were broken at times. So just because David had not only become a guest of their city, but had saved their lives more or less, doesn't mean that they're not going to turn right around and break those rules of hospitality. Because when it comes right down to it, most of the time, people care more about their own lives than they do the life of somebody else, no matter what that somebody else has done for them. Okay. So, well, obviously, David's got to get out of there, which is what happens next. David and his men, about 600 now, So we've gone up a couple hundred. We had 400 earlier. Now we got 600. They get up and they get out of there. They go from Kailua, and it says they went wherever they could. You know, I'm sure they're kind of moving around place to place. Then it was told Saul that David had escaped from there, and so he gives up. He gives up his pursuit. David moved from there into the wilderness, into the strongholds. And it says he remained in the hill country in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul sought him day in and day out, but God did not deliver him into his hand.
That's an interesting way that ends, right? Saul makes a statement, God has delivered him into my hand. And this sort of section ends with, I didn't.
Yeah, that's a great point. No, Saul, you would be grossly mistaken. By the way, a little Hebrew tidbit here for you. The word for stronghold in verse 14, that David stayed in the wilderness in the strongholds. So the Hebrew there is Matsuda, and you probably all heard of Masada, which was this, you know, large, I don't know what you want to call it, mountain, I suppose, where you had a fortress that was built. You can still visit that today when you go to Israel. Well, Masada is formed from this word Matsuda. So Masada just means stronghold or fortress. And probably because this word occurs most frequently in reference to places in the wilderness, these are probably not what we think of as some sort of like walled stronghold that an army might build and stay inside. This is probably just some sort of physical part of the landscape, some part of the landscape that has just natural barriers, boundaries that are more easily defended. So when you hear strongholds, don't necessarily think of something man-made. Just think of something that was easy, some natural part of the landscape that's easier to defend.
You know, there's something supernatural about David's hiding, because if it was just David and like two other guys, like his buddies, like running around trying to hide from Saul, seems doable. I mean, you're just like, you're outside, you have the entire country you're hiding in. If you want to, 600 guys is hard to hide.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of guys, man.
It's lot of people to hide. It's a lot of people to, as we mentioned, I think last time, it's a lot of people to feed too.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard to hide 600 people.
That's a big grocery bill. Imagine, yeah, you got 600 teenagers and you're trying to feed that many. Yeah, that's a lot of people to take care of.
I mean, it's a little miraculous. It is almost like God has blinded Saul and the people who are looking for David. How can you not find 600 guys?
Yeah, it's got to be pretty easy to spot, right? Well, Saul is definitely on the lookout for them. And says David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And now, all of a sudden, we have our final appearance of Jonathan, at least our final appearance of Jonathan with David. So we had that long, long conversation with them a couple chapters back where Jonathan met with David after he had ascertained that, in fact, his father, Saul, was out to murder David. Jonathan didn't want to believe it, but finally he did believe it. He made a pact with David. They had a sort of a tearful goodbye, but they're going to meet one more time. And this one more time here is in chapter 23, 15 or 16 and following. So even though Saul can't find David, Jonathan can. Jonathan went out to David at Horesh, and it says he encouraged him, as the New American Standard has it, or as the ESV has it, he strengthened his hand, I believe is the translation that they have there, which is more literal. So he, I don't know how the best way to translate it might be. He basically encouraged him. He told him that God was going to be by his side and to bring him through this. Verse 17 is his exact words. He says, "Don't be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you, and Saul my father knows that also." This is the first time that Jonathan has been quite this explicit about what he thinks the future is going to hold. And it's both true and untrue at the same time. He is correct that David will in fact be king over Israel. He is not correct when he says that he will be literally second to you. So it says next to you, but the Hebrew there is, I will be second in reference to you. So in other words, I'm going to be basically your right-hand man. I will rule alongside you, or I'll be your first guy, something like that. But of course, that won't happen. Jonathan and his father will both die in the same battle in a few more chapters. But you can kind of see what's happening in Jonathan's mind. It's like he has resolved himself to the fact, he knows that his line will not be the regal line that's going to reign in Israel. He knows that David and his line will be those who serve as kings. But he also wants to be with David. He wants to be his supporter, his encourager, the one that he turns to, so his second, so that he might be there with David. But you know, whether this is just optimism or whether he is naive or something has led him to think that this is going to happen, whatever the why is for him thinking this, it's not going to be the case.
You know, you think about the life of David as a king. I mean, David is obviously largely considered a good king. He might have been an even better king had he had Jonathan at his side during the time. There might have been some instances in David's life that would have been better if you had a guy like Jonathan.
Yeah, if I were ever cursed enough to become king of something, it would not be a blessing. Then I would definitely want a Jonathan by my side. Like if I had the choice, God says, "All right, Chad, you're gonna be king over this island." I'd be like, "All right, but only if I have Jonathan right beside me."
Yeah,
it's the only one of the way this is gonna happen. Yeah, I mean, David was a great king, but just imagine what a greater king he would have been if he had a man like Jonathan to stand by his side. So the two of them make a covenant as they had before the Lord. And it says, David stayed in Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. So this was the final time that David and Jonathan will see each other in this life. And now, after that very brief bit of positivity, now we have one more act of betrayal. Verse 19 says, the Ziphites, remember that David is in the territory, the wilderness of Ziph. The people that live there, not all of them, but some of them, the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, which of course was Saul's hometown. And they said, is not David hiding with us in the strongholds at Horesh? Then we have all this whole list of geographical references. At Horesh, on the hill of Hahilah, which is on the south side of Yeshimon.
Getting real specific with this locale.
Very specific. It sure seems that way in the translation. It's a little bit tricky because Horesh means forest. So is it the strongholds at the forest, or is Horesh an actual like place name? The hill of Hahilah is a place, and then which is on the south side of Yeshimon. That's either a place name or it just means the desert or the wasteland. Either way, it seems like they are pretty sure they know exactly where David is to be found. By the way, we mentioned this before, that certain events in David's life end up as introductions to certain of the Psalms. If you turn to Psalm 54, it says that this was written when the Ziphites came to Saul and said, is not David hiding among us? It's a short psalm. I think it's 5 verses, something like that. So check out Psalm 54. And this is a song that David wrote after he was betrayed by the Ziphites. So they go on and they say, more or less, come down. You know, you want to catch David? We know where he's at. So we will surrender him into your hand. verse 21. Once more, Saul is going to take the Lord's name in vain. May you be blessed of Yahweh. May you be blessed of the Lord, for you have had compassion on me.
This is a big thing for Saul. Like one of the striking things that Saul says before he slaughters all the priests is basically, no one feels sorry for me. That's really frustrating, right?
Yeah.
He's really annoyed that like no one feels bad for him.
And, yeah, finally somebody does.
Yeah, so he's saying to these guys, you know what? Bless you. Finally, someone has had compassion on my pitiable situation here.
Yeah. What makes this even stranger is that the word for compassion is chamal. And if you go back to 1 Samuel 15, it occurs three times there. It's the whole scene where he spares Agag. You know, he's supposed to go in and wipe out all the Amalekites, but he spares the king along with the choices of the livestock. The word for spare is chamal, the same word that's used here. So he sparingly showed pity to the king and to these animals. He uses the same word here. So they have sparingly showed pity to him, which in a strange way puts him in the same position as King Agag had been in, which is odd. That's not a position that you want to hold. But either way, yeah, he's finally found somebody that he thinks cares for him. Now, I'm guessing here, but I don't suppose the Ziphites really cared for Saul. They probably just are like, you know what? If Saul finds out that we knew where David was and we didn't tell Saul, he's likely to come in and massacre all of us. So, yeah. Hey, we
some real fear-motivated compassion here.
Yeah, yeah, not really the truest form of compassion. Well, he's still not sure. He's like, all right, verse 22. I mean, that's good, but would you do me a favor? Would you like make sure, and then would you make double and triply sure? Why don't you go down and check it out, see where he's hiding, and make sure that he's there? Because I'm told he's very cunning.
Yeah, so word has come to me that this guy is elusive.
Yeah, yeah, you might have a little experience with that, Saul, just a little bit. So verse 23, go and figure out where his hiding places are, and then come back to me and let me know, and then I'll go with you. And then we will search him out, even if we have to go among the thousands of Judah. But you can tell Saul is getting to the point where he's thinking, all right, well, I've been told before that he's at a certain place, and I show up, and he ain't there no more. So make sure. Verse 24, they go, and then David and his men, they are in the wilderness of Maon in the Arabah to the south of this desert region. So Saul, this by the way, is, I think, the closest that Saul ever comes to actually getting David. Saul and his men, they go down there, and they're told where David's at, that he's in the wilderness of Maon. So he pursues David down there. And verse 26 has was probably what's called a pincer movement in military battles. It's where you attack both flanks of your opposition. So you're coming down from either side. So David is on one side of the mountain, and then Saul and his troops seem to be coming from either side of the mountain, if you can kind of picture that. So Saul, as it were, divides his troops, and one's coming from the left, one's coming from the right. And David's men are trying to get away because they're surrounding David. They're about to seize him. As I said, this is probably the closest that he ever comes actually getting David. And just on the cusp of victory, all of a sudden, Saul gets this message. A messenger shows up, probably a runner, and says, hurry and come, because the Philistines have made a raid on the land. So after that, Saul is like, all right. So he goes back from pursuing David, and he has to go and fight the Philistines. And because of this, it says they called that place where David was the Rock of Escape. At least that's the way the New American Standard has it translated. And I believe, yeah, that's the way that ESV has it as well, the Rock of Escape. I'm not actually sure why they translated the Rock of Escape, because it's more like the Rock of Division, where there's a division here, a dividing between David and the forces of Saul. Either way, however you want to translate that, it's where David does in fact escape, because he's divided from the forces of Saul. David leaves there, goes up and stays at the stronghold of En Gedi, or Ein Gedi, which is a oasis or a spring. Ain means spring. So it's a spring that's on the side of the Dead Sea, that rocky, real rocky, cliffy region where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. It's full of caves and places to hide. En Gedi is famous as a very fertile place within a desert environment. So that's where David is going to stay. Now, I thought it was funny when the messenger shows up that the Philistines actually sort of save David in this case.
Yeah, this is God using the Philistines.
Unwittingly, of course.
Yeah, God using the Philistines to save David. Saul's probably thinking, I got David, and then someone comes up and said, oh my gosh, the Philistines are attacking the land in retaliation for what David did when they wiped them all out.
Yeah, he's like, I can't get away from this guy. Yeah. All these scenes remind me of, all those times that everyone was after Christ, and he'd slip away, just like they had him. Well, he preaches his first sermon, they take him to the cliff, they're going to throw him off the cliff, and then Jesus just kind of gets away.
Just slips through their hands, whatever that means.
Slips through their hands, yeah. He's like always slipping through their hands. So like his father, David, the son of David, knows how to get away, at least from his persecutors for
he knows how to get away when he doesn't mean to get caught. He does not get caught.
right.
Yes.
So when he's caught, it's no accident.
And that's what he says. So he says, I give up my life. No one takes it from me. You can't take anything from him.
Yeah.
So, well, right on. Well, that's 40 minutes. That is the closest Saul's going to get to David, but it's not the closest David's going to get to Saul, as we will probably find out next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, we'll see you then.